Let's get started. The couple of announcements. The TA is willing to hold another LISP recitation session for those of you, you know, who would like just like a general description of LISP, how to deal with it rather than have specific questions. He's happy to do it tomorrow during his office hours, 3 to 4. He wanted me to check how many of you would be interested in going, just so that he can decide whether to hold them or not. He'll still have his office hours. The question is, you can always go to his office hours anyway, but if there are enough people who need some like a help with LISP, he can either redo or do a more advanced version of the LISP presentation that he did last time. Anybody who thinks they would be interested in going tomorrow? 1, 2, 3. Okay. Okay. What? 3 to 4. Okay. So I think in that case, you probably are better. By the way, you should be able to make appointments with the TA separately. Okay. You can send him a mail and make an appointment and then talk to him. That's very much feasible. If you can't make it during the office hour. Since it's only two, probably he's more likely to do it one-on-one. So just show up and then he can help you. Okay. So the other thing is that the blog seems to be doing very well. If your name doesn't exist here, you should be worried, because that means you haven't signed up. And there's a bunch of things that are going on there. Either people are really desperate about getting the participation credit, or they actually have interesting things that they wanted to say, but it seems a lot is being posted there. So I decided that if I just respond to every one of them, which I love to do, probably you'll get sick of me and I'll probably not get anything else done. So I recruited more people to read all the comments that are being posted, and you know, so these are not necessarily class homework sorts of stuff. You can still ask questions about class homework, everything, to me and the TA, but these guys are basically experts in AI, in the sense they're senior grad students, and they are also on the blog now, and they get to read your comments, and if there are things that if I don't get a chance to respond, they can always respond. So I'm just pointing that out to you. So feel free to use it as a discussion forum of things related to the class, as well as things slightly outside of the class. For example, much of the discussion that's been going on right now on the forum is really slightly outside of what you would wind up doing, which is things like human intelligence and connections to human intelligence. Okay. That's the administrative stuff. Next Monday, we don't have a class. Wednesday, we have a class. Wednesday, the assignment 0 is due. Okay? Any questions before I start the discussion for today? Which one? So assignment 0, as I said, it's mostly for you guys to start doing LISP programming and realizing whether or not you're up to the mark. Okay. If you're having trouble with it, then rather than start worrying about it next week when the assignment, the project 1 would be out, you have at least like a 2 weeks notice that you have trouble. So all we are basically saying is that, it's not being graded for a large credit. No, it'll be like a very small amount of credit for just doing this. That's it. Okay, but it's mostly to force you to come to terms with your LISP knowledge. That's it. Any other questions? Okay. So today's discussion is basically a continuation of last class. And in last class, what we were doing was we were looking at problem-solving agents and how they could represent the world in terms of states. So here is an example where the city names are the states, and the children generator function essentially takes a state and generates all the other states that can be accessed. Okay, and the goal test function say takes a state and says whether or not that is a goal state. That's the only thing that we care about. And given this, the point of finding a path from initial state to the goal state would be a graph search. So we would be obviously looking at graph search algorithms, some of which you already know. I also pointed out last time that here you have states which are essentially, each state is just a single entity. It's the name of the city. Okay, so you can have states in terms of problem solving agent. You can have states which are just opaque entities, S1, S2, etc., S1000, and your program basically doesn't need to know anything about the internal structure of the state. Okay, all that matters is some function called child generator takes some state S and gives you a set of states which would be the children state. Okay, and similarly another one called goal test takes a state and returns true false, saying whether or not that state is a goal state. Okay, and if you have that information, you can actually do search on these kind of graphs. But I also pointed out that there are domains such as vacuum world where in fact you may wind up noticing that the states have internal structure of their own. Okay, so in this particular case, the state is made up of three state variables. So each state is made up of three state variables, and if you give the values for each of the state variables, then you have completely specified the state. Okay, so in this particular case, since there are three state variables and they're all Boolean, they can be true false for two of them. Is there dirt in room one and room two? Those are the true false ones. And is the robot, is the vacuum cleaner in the right or the left room? That's also a Boolean variable, turns out. Okay, so you essentially have three Boolean variables, and so you have how many possible states? 2^3 states. Okay, so you can think in terms of the size of the state space in terms of the state variables. So in the worst case, if you have n Boolean variables, you have 2^n states, or rather if you have v Boolean variables, then you have 2^v states. Okay,
what are the state variables in this example?
In this particular case, the state variables are, for example, which room is the robot in, right or left, and is there dirt in room 1, is there dirt in room 2.
Oh, okay.
Those are the three state variables I've decided.
All right.
Yes. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things is so if I happen to know the initial state where I am in, and I know I need to go to some goal state, right? Then essentially, I'm searching in a graph like this, where one of the, maybe this is my initial state, and hopefully I'm trying to reach one of these states as a goal state. Okay. So that would be a simple graph search problem. Now, what if I don't know where I am to begin with? Suppose I don't know where I am to begin with. I, the vacuum cleaner, don't know which state I am in. I don't know whether I'm in the right or the left. And when I say where I am, I don't necessarily just mean which room I am in, but I don't know which state I am in. So I don't know whether I'm in the room left or room right. I don't know whether there is dirt in the room one or not, and I don't know whether there's dirt in the room two or not. In that case, in essence, what I know is I am in one of these eight states. Suppose I happen to know that both rooms are dirty, but I don't know which room I am in. Then I must be in one of these two states, right? So not knowing enough about your initial state basically gets turned into uncertainty. So the uncertainty about states can be modeled in terms of saying that initially you are in a set of states. Okay, that set would be a subset of the total state space. Now in this particular case, there are eight states in this state space. So if you allow uncertainty about which state you are in, then you can consider all the subsets of these eight states, right? So that means you would have, if there are V variables, you have 2^v states, and you have 2 power 2 power v subsets of states, okay, and we would call them, and so it would look like this. So we each of these are essentially sets of states, okay, and there could be, in this particular case, there could be 2 power 2 power 3 or 2 power 8 possible subsets of states, okay. Notice of course that this graph doesn't have 2 power 2 power 3, because some of those possible belief states are impossible to reach starting from any legal state. Yes?
I noticed if you do actions LS, RS, you always get to that very bottom left state.
Mm-hmm. So the idea is that, I mean, that's the next point, which is, so first of all, you realize that when you lose sensing, I mean, when you don't know which state you are in essence, you are searching in a much larger graph. Instead of searching in a 2 power V graph, you're searching in a 2 power 2 power v graph. Point one, okay? So that makes the, you know, to the extent, even without knowing anything about search algorithms, you can tell that if the graph that you're searching on is much larger, in particular exponentially larger, then you would assume, all, you know, unless you have some other, you know, few tricks, you would assume that the search would be exponentially harder, okay? So if you have state uncertainty, you would have exponentially harder search in this case. By the way, if you happen to not know which state you are in, but you have a probability distribution, and how, so for example, this particular state actually says, I could be in this real state, this, etc. Okay? But I don't know what is the probability that I am in any of them. So this is truly non-deterministic. Okay? What if it is stochastic? That means I actually know some of the probabilities. I know, for example, that I'm most likely in this or this state. So 0.4 here, 0.4 here, and the 0.2 is distributed over these states. Okay, then what would be the size of the state space then? Do you understand what the question I asked? So basically, I'm asking, if you happen to know more than what you have here, in this case, you don't know what's the probability that you are in specific states. Okay? But suppose you happen to know in the beginning the probabilities associated with which state you are in. Okay? It's a distribution over the states. So essentially, then you are actually looking for distribution over these eight states, eight world states, such that you have to give numbers between 0 and 1 to all these eight states such that they add up to 1. And each way of giving it will be a separate distribution. Okay, so how many such distributions are there? Infinite. So the moment you actually have stochastic distribution, I mean, if you have more knowledge in terms of how much of a probability you are, what's the probability that you are in this state versus this state versus this state, in a way the problem becomes a continuous space problem, because you are now looking in terms of infinite number of state sets with their distribution. Okay? In particular, I would use this word called belief state, this phrase called belief state. A belief state is a set of world states. Okay? And if the belief state is a singleton, that means you know exactly where you are. Okay? If a belief state, in the worst case, a belief state could be as large, its cardinality could be as large as the number of states in the original world, number of distinct states in the original world, okay? And then once you start having stochastic, once you start having the distribution on these states, then there are infinite number of belief states, because, you know, you could have infinite variations of this particular set of states where you keep changing the probability number such that they still add up to 1. Okay, so that's from the point of view of what happens to the underlying state space graph. Another question I have while looking at this is, in fact, is it actually possible, you know, if you see this graph right now, right, this is actually showing that even though, so in the previous one you had each of these are states, and if you go right, so if you are in this state and the robot does the go right action, in essence, it will be in this state. The robot basically shifted to the right side. I'm showing it in pictures, but really these would be state variables. You know, previously the state variable has dirt in the room 1, has dirt in the room 2 are true, and the robot is in room, robot is in left room. That was its value. Now after going right, after doing the right action, these two will still have their old values. Robot now would be in the left room. I'm sorry, right room. Okay? Right. So as you do actions, you're going from, you know, one state to another state and so on. And so you can actually see that if you are here and you need to be here, since it's a small enough state space, you can actually look at the graph and see whether or not there is a way of getting. Is there connected? Are these connected? Are these nodes connected? Is there a way of coming here? Yes, there is a way. Now the question is, in this case, if I am in one of these states, let's say in the beginning I don't know where I am at all, and in the end I want to be in a completely clean state. That means both rooms are clean and the robot is hanging around either in the left or right room. Is that possible given this particular picture? Yes, because what's happening is if you are here and you do right action, okay, you don't know which of these states you are in, but when you do right action, you are only in one of these four states. It's beautiful. What this is telling you is that when you do an action, it typically can reduce your state uncertainty. It can also increase. It can also increase your state uncertainty when you do actions. But one of the useful things about doing actions is they can reduce the state uncertainty. Okay? So without knowing where I am, I know that if I do a right, I will be in one of these states. Then if I do a suck, I will be in one of these two states. Okay? Then I do a left, I will be in one of these two states. Then I do a suck, I will be in this state. Have I opened my eyes? No, I don't have eyes. I still was able to go from here to here. So I can give you a guarantee that after doing these actions, I would be in the goal state. Okay, so this kind of scenario is essentially called conformant planning. And you heard at least one other scenario where conformant planning was feasible. That was the bomb in the toilet, right? You didn't know which package has the bomb, and still you were able to get to a safe state. Okay? Now, it's not necessary that conformant plans are always possible. It may well be that if you don't have any sensing actions, in the end you cannot completely remove uncertainty. Even though it is true that actions tend to reduce uncertainty, it's not necessary that all the uncertainty goes away by the end. Okay? That brings up the question of sensing actions. Suppose you were to do a sensing. Suppose you are here and you can do a sensing action which basically all it tells you is it won't change the world. It'll tell you true or false for a condition. So you can ask this question, okay, this is a 20 questions thing. So I don't know where I am, but I get to ask questions. Okay, my question is, so does the left room have dirt? That's the question I ask. The answer is going to be either yes or no. I don't know when I ask the question. If I know what the answer is going to be, why ask? Right? So when I was about to ask this question, I knew that it will be either yes or no. Okay, so when I'm in this belief state, if I asked, does the left room have dirt? And if the answer comes out saying no, the left room doesn't have dirt, okay, then essentially that means for that particular thing, I would kill this state, this state, this state, this state. And the other branch where I say left room does have dirt, I will kill I will kill the other four and keep these four. So what does sensing do for you? Sensing also reduces uncertainty. Sensing also reduces uncertainty. Doing actions reduces uncertainty oftentimes. Okay? And doing sensing reduces uncertainty also. Except when you do sensing, the problem is you during the question that you ask is going to be done during the runtime when you are actually doing the execution. Okay, so the plan that you would make, so previously the plan for going from here to a clean state would be a sequence of actions. Go right, do suck, do left, do suck. Those are the actions and you'd be done. It's a sequence of actions. Okay, if I decide to use sensing actions, then I would have something like this. From wherever you are, ask a question. Okay, and if it says yes, do something. If it says no, do something else. So the plan that you make now, the solution that you make now is going to be conditional. It'll be more like a tree. Okay? So, so when you start having, when you start doing sensing actions, the solution is a tree and it has branches and you make the entire tree. Okay? Oftentimes, a problem might have both a non-sensing solution, not nonsense solution, but non-sensing solution, and a sensing solution. And you get to decide which one to pick. And people do it all the time. So for example, you go to your doctor and you say, you know, I'm having my fever. Okay, what do I do? If doctors are basically told to do enough blood tests to figure out whether or not you have a viral infection or a bacterial infection, and if it's viral infection, ask you to go home and sleep. And if it's a bacterial infection, give penicillin, you know. But your cheapo insurance company doesn't pay for the test. So you go and tell your doctor, I'm having a fever. They say, yeah, here is antibiotic, take it. And then we take a lot of these antibiotics, we become immune to them. But that's a different story, okay? And similarly, we had the, you know, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq case. We did some amount of sensing. At one point, we said we should do the nonsense plan or no sensing plan, which is let's not sense, let's just go in, okay? And after that, of course, you know, there may not be a country, in which case there is more certainty. But the point here is, depending on the cost of sensing actions versus cost of causal actions, some, you know, doing sensing may be a costlier or a cheaper alternative. So the same problems might have multiple types of solutions. Okay? Okay, so that's enough about the state spaces. Here's one more state space which you will be get sick and tired of by the end of the project one, which is this tile puzzle problems. Okay, so if you have a tile puzzle, then what would be the state? So the state would be what? It would be the position of various tiles. Okay, and what would be the operator? The interesting thing is there are multiple ways of writing the operators. The best way in this case is to think of moving the blank, okay, rather than moving the tiles, which would make it look as if you have lots and lots of actions. Okay, most of them are not applicable most of the time. Really, the freedom you have in the tile puzzle, by the way, you guys know tile puzzles, right? Okay, so the freedom you have in tile puzzle is you move something into the blank, so you can act as if, from the point of view of the actual underlying physics of the problem, you can just act as if it's a blank that's being moved. So you can move the blank, in this case, left, move the blank right, you can't move it in this case. Okay, if you move it right, it'll just stay in the same place. You can move it down, you can move it up. You can't move in this case up, okay? So those are the four actions, yes?
There's about 9 factorial states and each one has either 2 or 4 transitions.
Yeah. So it can have 2 or 3 or 4 transitions.
Yeah.
Right? And what's more beautiful in this case is if I give you a state, so normally how do tile puzzles go? I give you an initial state and I'll give you a goal state. And you are supposed to come up with a sequence of these blank movement actions which will allow you to convert it from here to here. Okay, agreed. Now, So I can have any state as a goal state. Some people like, you know, to actually assume that there's a standard goal state. This guy, in this case, I'm assuming the standard goal state is to have blank in the middle. Another standard goal state could be to have blank in the last tile there. But there is no such thing as standard. Any state is a goal state, any state can be an initial state. Now here's the interesting question to think about. If I give you any pair of initial and goal state combinations, would there be a way of reaching from initial state to goal state? Can you write down the state space for the tile puzzle as you did here? I'm sorry, this is actually harder. This was a state space for the vacuum problem, right? What was the state space for the map problem? That itself is a state space, right? Because the edges are the roads, so that's the state space, and you know, with the connections and so on. So the question is it all that easy to write the state space for the puzzle problems? Not really. Okay, in fact, if you can see the state space in front of you, why bother taking, you know, computer algorithms and so on? Most of the issue in terms of actually dealing with search in this class, as again as doing search in 310, data structures where you did depth first, breadth first, and all that stuff, is we assume that the state spaces are so humongous that you will never want to, you would never want to represent them explicitly. So the graph corresponding to the state space is never represented explicitly. Because many a time the graph is infinitely large, and still there may be a solution that is finite number of moves from the state you're starting from. So the guy who says, let me first write down the graph, then start looking for the solution, is dead before starting. Okay? So much of what we will do is to think of search where you implicitly expand only the parts of the graph that are relevant. And so that even though the underlying state space is actually infinitely large, or very large or infinitely large, you would still be able to reach the goal if in fact there is a finite number of actions to reach the goal. Okay, so 8 puzzle is a small search space really by computer standards, because this can be solved very easily. The next would be what puzzle? After 8 puzzle, what do you get? Do you get a 9 puzzle? If you are into the puzzle world, do you get a 9 puzzle? No, you get the 15 puzzle. And then you get, by 15 puzzle, things start becoming interesting. Okay, by the, what's the next one? 24 puzzle. 24 puzzle, we can't solve most of the instances optimally. Yeah, but I mean, I'm talking about square ones, the square ones right now. So the 24 puzzle, which is a 5 by 5 square, given any arbitrary initial and goal states, finding the optimal sequence of moves to go from the initial to goal state is beyond, still close to the edge of the capabilities of the current computer. Now you might say, why are you so silly as to spend your life looking at 25 puzzles? Okay. You could also say that to biologists who keep playing with the fruit flies, saying, you know, what the heck, haven't you seen anything more interesting than fruit flies? You know, I mean, they're kids, they're people, right? The reason you deal with fruit flies is the same reason you deal with n puzzles, because they provide a simpler scenario where you can exercise the efficiency of search algorithms. Okay, if you cannot, I mean, 24 puzzle is hard, and if you cannot solve 24 puzzle, if you can solve 24 puzzles quite well using some great idea, you know, for optimal solution, then maybe you can then use it for other scenarios too. Okay, it's just one more problem, just like the vacuum cleaner problem, just like the Arad problem, and so on. Okay, one other interesting thing about the tile puzzles is, is it the case that if I give you an initial state and a goal state, there will always be a path connecting initial state to the goal state? How many of you think there will be a path connecting initial to goal state?
For just the puzzle?
Yeah, for just 8 puzzles. So I give you one initial state and one goal state. Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, I mean, probably won't cut it. I want yes or no.
Okay.
Sorry. Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. It has nothing to do with the size of the puzzle.
Well,
it's just the size of the, I mean, basically, the n puzzle problems have disconnected state spaces. Yes. The way to do it is the following. In case you want to make one of your friends spend their lifetime trying to solve an 8 puzzle problem, do the following. Okay, start with any state, let's say this state, okay, physically remove two tiles, swap them, and then start moving them around. You're dead, because the moment you swap two tiles physically, right, you will never be, you essentially, there are, the state space of the 8 puzzle is such that there's one connected graph here, one connected graph here, corresponding to the odd and even permutations. And you will never be able to get from one to the other unless you remove tiles out. Okay, it's a cute theory for it. Yes?
I used to do Rubik's Cube a lot, and towards the very end of solving, you can tell if someone's taken a couple of them and twisted them, and it just doesn't.
Yeah. So in this case, actually, we are doing illegal things. You know, we are basically making a state, right, which, so you will always be able to solve it in the following way. So in fact, one way I can give you questions on the exam is start with a question, answer it myself, and then say, here is the question, can you reach this answer? The way that I really like is give a question and hope you'll find me the answer. Okay. So in this case, if I started with this, made a huge number of legal moves, and looked at where I reached, and then gave you that as the goal state, this as the initial state, of course they are solvable, because you solved it. But what I did here is I started from this, and I did an illegal thing. I removed the tiles and swapped them. And then it looks, for naked eyes, it looks like it's just a normal problem, except you can't solve it. Okay, which is an interesting point, because this means that state spaces can be disjoint. And that's exactly what actually, so because of which, if you are in one part of the state space, you don't get to see the other part at all. There is no legal way you can get to the other part. Okay. So in this case, goal test, you know, you look at whatever is my goal state, and I check whether it's my goal state or not. And now the other thing, when I talk about shortest path, etc., one issue is, what's the cost of a solution? When I say optimal cost, you know, optimal way of solving, what do I mean by optimal? Presumably, I have given a sequence of moves, I can give a real number corresponding to that sequence of moves and say it's this costly. Okay? Normally, the way you compute those costs is in terms of the cost per move. And the simplest way to assume is each move has one unit cost. And so in this case, the length is the same, so the depth is the same as the cost. Okay? The simplest idea is to think that the depth is the same as the cost. But much of the search algorithms we look at would not care whether you actually have unit cost or non-uniform cost. In the beginning, we look at unit cost ones, but they can deal with non-uniform cost too. Okay? And when you have non-uniform cost, a longer solution in terms of moves might be cheaper than a shorter solution in terms of moves. You know this already, right? I mean, taking 15 different flights to reach your home country is oftentimes cheaper than taking one flight, you know, while you have your legs spread out happily, because that costs a lot more in terms of the ticket cost. Okay, so those are the kinds of things that you can think of for any of the problems. The next thing we want to do now is keeping all these problems, all of them essentially have one commonality, which is they have states, and you start from initial state, go towards the goal state. I'm trying to find a pattern. Okay, how to solve this? One simple idea, which is obviously you know this, is graph search algorithms. So you start off, initialize the search tree by start giving the initial state and giving the child generator function, giving the goal test function. Okay, and what you do is you have a queue of states to be expanded, which you originally initialize to the first state, and then you go into this loop. If there are no more candidates for expansion, and you haven't yet gotten out of the loop, obviously you exhausted the space, you didn't find the solution, you're dead. Otherwise, you pick a node from the queue, and how to pick is an interesting issue. Pick a node from the queue, and as soon as you pick it, before you expand it, ask the goal test function, does it satisfy the goal test? If it says it satisfies the goal test, you say, oops, I'm done, and you show this node and go home. If not, I expand it. This is search. That's it. And the only difference for the huge number of search algorithms we will look at is obviously how are the nodes enqueued and dequeued. What's the methodology for enqueuing, dequeuing? Again, initial parts of this must be quite obvious to you all because you have done depth first and breadth first in your data structures. Okay. So basically, you would start with something like the initial state might be arad, and I want to get to, what is this? I can't even read, Timisoara or something? I forgot the name. By the way, Narvik apparently has Romanian ancestry. So these are all nice towns from Romania. I just want to remember that name. I can't read this. Yeah, Bucharest, of course. If you're in Romania, you want to go to Bucharest. So you started from Arad, you want to get to Bucharest. So you, what you do, you initialize the queue with Arad, and then you check, you go into this loop which checks, is Arad where you want it to be? Okay, the search algorithm itself doesn't know. What it says is, here is Arad, and gives it to that goal test function, which says true or false. If it says true, it's done. If it's false, then it will extend Arad. How does it extend Arad? It also doesn't know how to extend it. All it does is it gives Arad to another function called child generator function, which is again problem specific, which in this case generates Sibu, Timisoara, and Zerinth. And they're put into the queue somehow, and then the next one is picked and so on. Okay. Now one interesting thing, of course, is I started from Arad, and suppose after I come to Sibu, I extended Sibu, I get Arad again. Right? I got Arad twice. I started from Arad, I went back to Arad. Now, from the point of view of the real world states, it's the same exact state that's here as here. From the point of view of the search algorithm, these are completely different. Any solution to go from Arad to Bucharest, which sees Arad more than once, is a suboptimal solution. Right? If it sees Arad more than once, you know, it's a suboptimal solution because you could always have just cut one of the, you're basically going in loop. Okay? So you want to be able to distinguish between this Arad and this Arad from the point of view of search. So we use the terminology called search node. And what a search node is a data structure, essentially. A search node essentially has, of course, a state which corresponds to that node. Okay, and then each search node has a parent node from which it was generated, and it has children nodes which are generated by expanding it. And you can throw in stuff like the depth of the search node, which can actually be computed by just going up its parent pointer until you reach the root node. Okay. And then cost also, which is for each of the edges you traverse, you can add up the cost. So that will be your cost value for reaching this node, this search node, starting from the root node. Okay. So the advantage of having this particular node versus state representation is that this is N0, which corresponds to node 0, which corresponds to Arad, whose depth is 0, whose cost is 0. This is N15 or something, you know, node for Arad, which has depth 2, cost 2. So as seen as nodes, they are completely different nodes. But they both have the same real world state. So it's a useful thing to keep this node terminology in mind, because what you queue in the search algorithms are the nodes, not the states. Because you can have multiple ways of getting to the same state, depending on whether or not there are cycles in the graph, underlying state space graph. Okay? If the graph is completely acyclic, that means once you leave a state, there is no operator you can do to get back to it, then the node versus state distinction goes away. Okay? If not, it's a very important distinction. Okay? We'll assume that we'll think in terms of nodes. Okay. So coming back to my implementation, so this is the actual implementation I'll do. I will make a queue with the nodes. Okay? The queue, originally I'll put the initial node. right? Which is this structure whose state happens to be the initial state of the problem. And then I go into the loop, and if the queue is empty, then I return failure. If not, I will remove from the front of the queue. So the only change now would be, I'll always be removing stuff from the front of the queue. So the question would be how the queue is organized when new things are coming in. I can change that, okay? And then I remove a node from the front of the queue, and if the goal test succeeds on this node, okay, then you just return that node itself as the answer. And of course, then the answer printing software can then do pretty printing, saying here is the state and here is the way you reached it from the root node by actually following the pointers back. Okay? And then, of course, if this is not the case, then you expand the node with the child generator function. Okay, so that will then give you a set of nodes, or a list of nodes. And then you have to throw them into the original queue. The way you throw them into the original queue, of course, changes from search algorithm to search algorithm. It can be a real queue, in which case guys coming in will stand in the back of the queue and people will be picked from the front of the queue. It can be a stack, in which case guys coming in will come to the front and get picked up from the front. Okay, last in, first out. Or it could be prioritized queue, where the nodes that come in would be sorted into the queue using some merit measure, which is some goodness of the node. Okay? And then they can be put anywhere. Now, of course, once I talk about goodness of a node, there are multiple ways of defining the goodness of the node that will lead to different ways of doing search. Okay? Now, so search algorithms differ based on the specific enqueuing that we do. And then all search algorithms must do goal test. This is, again, I'm repeating this. You have to remember this in the back of your head. All our analysis assumes that you do goal test only when you are about to expand a node. Just because a goal node happens to be somewhere on the queue doesn't mean you're done. Many a time, there are all sorts of suboptimal goal nodes hanging about on the queue. Okay? The only way you can talk about optimizing the search is when it picks up the node for expansion. If it is a goal node, then it will stop. And then we'll try to prove in for optimal search algorithms that that strategy will not allow you to get any suboptimal solution. Okay, so this is a important convention that we'll keep in mind. Okay, and then the other thing is we will find it. So in general, the state graph can be any arbitrary graph, right? They can be cyclic graphs, they can be acyclic graphs, they can have large branching factors, small branching factors, uniform branching factors, non-uniform branching factors, all sorts of fun stuff. So what we find to, you know, the simplest case with respect to which we will tend to do our analysis is this thing called uniform search tree. This is only for the analysis. The search algorithms themselves must work on whatever is the underlying search graph. Okay, this is a good abstraction to think in terms of. Okay, so what is a uniform search tree? You would assume that the search tree, that the state space essentially looks like this. It's directed. So once you leave this node, you can't come back to it. And from each node, you get B children nodes. It's a uniform search tree of B, in this case 4. Okay, and if you grow it to depth D, then the last level will have B power D nodes. Okay, so it's a simple scenario. So this is B power 0 nodes, B power 1 nodes, B power 2 nodes, B power 3 nodes, and so on. Okay, so that's the model that we'll keep in mind when we talk about the complexities of search algorithms. Okay, any questions? Okay. So the question then, the next thing is, what do we care about search algorithms? So I already said, essentially, it's a bunch of queuing strategies. And what are the things different between different queuing strategies? What are the things that we care about? Okay. In terms of search, we care about at least the following properties. Completeness, which only says that if there is a solution to the problem, then you will find a solution for the problem. Notice that I didn't say that I'll find the optimal solution. I'll just find a solution. That's completeness. So it is possible that there are problems for which there are solutions, and if your search strategy is incomplete, then it will fail to find them. Okay? It will fail to find them either by not terminating at all and going into la-la land, doing looping, or of terminating saying, I didn't find a solution, when there is actually a solution. So that would be completeness. Obviously, you care about completeness of a search strategy. The next thing is time complexity. How long does it take for it to find the solution? Okay? And then space complexity, which is how much memory does it take to find the solution? Now, in terms of search algorithms, you could think of time complexity ultimately in terms of the number of node expansions, because ultimately the largest, the costliest thing you would wind up doing in the search is this expand operation, which takes a node and generates all its children nodes. And depending upon the problem, you know, it can be large number of nodes. So you would think of time complexity not in terms of CPU seconds, because CPUs can change, but in terms of the number of nodes expanded. Okay? Just the number of nodes expanded. The space complexity, on the other hand, what part of this search algorithm takes the most amount of space? Essentially, the queue, data structure. How large is the queue? Okay? So the only thing that you care about in terms of space complexity is what is the size of the queue. The question is, should you care about the average size of the queue, because the queue starts big, I mean, starts very small, and maybe it ends big or ends small in the end. The question is, I mean, and during the search, the queue size could be increasing, reducing, increasing, reducing. So what do I care about in terms of the space complexity? Obviously, the maximum size that the queue ever reached. Okay? The only thing that you care about is the maximum size that the queue ever reached. So that's the space complexity. Because again, if your program ever needs one byte more than what you have in your memory, it'll die. Okay? And then optimality, which is, does it find the least cost solution? Remember that you want to provide a guarantee for this, because when it does goal test and the goal test says, yes, you have a goal in your hand, the search comes out and says, here is the solution. Okay? You can't then go and check whether or not it's optimal. That's like a sucker's game. Because then I'll always give you some random solution and you'll spend your lifetime trying to figure out whether it's optimal or not by considering all the other solutions. Okay? What you want is when a proof saying if when the search algorithm ends and gives you a solution, it's guaranteed to be optimal. Okay? If there exists in the million times of running it, there is a possibility that it could be inoptimal once, then it's inoptimal. Because you don't know which one time is going to occur to you. Okay? So optimal means every time it will send you the optimal solution. Yes?
What if you just have, you go through until you find three goals and take the best one?
So what happens then?
So what happens is that you have the best goal of three.
Yeah, but that's not optimal. It's just best of those three, right? So the question is, for the underlying state space, think about it this way. If I give you the underlying state space of the problem, however big it is, suppose I wrote it down on a piece of paper with the nodes and edges, okay? There is a well-defined optimal shortest path between the starting node and the ending node. My question is, when your search algorithm ended, did it give you that optimal path or not? Without having to go through the entire testing process, I need a guarantee that it would have found you the optimal path. What you're doing is trying to be so that, you know, what you did, unfortunately, not to make a point about it, but oftentimes the way, if you are a consultant for somebody and you want to make them feel, so they come to you and say, we have the following problem to be solved and we are willing to pay you tons of money, and we want a good solution, optimal solution. One way you can make them, you know, if you actually just give them a solution, they're likely to say, yeah, you didn't spend that much time. So one idea you would do is, here I thought about it for like 2 days, here are 3 solutions and I think this is the best one. And that might make them feel warm and fuzzy and give you the money, but it doesn't mean a thing. You know, there is only one optimum, and the only way it's optimum is because you can actually prove that if you consider all the possible solutions, this is the one with the shortest cost. We'll see. Wait. Okay. What's interesting is we'll find that getting optimality is very easy. Very easy. Okay, you can always get optimality if only you don't have to worry about time complexity. Okay. So getting optimality is not a problem. Okay. So again, the notation we'll use in terms of talking about these complexities are branching factor would be B, depth is D, and you know M is the maximum depth to which the search space grows. Okay, let's look at some of the simple search strategies that you already know. These three all of you know, these two you may or may not know, and I hope to go through all of them today. Okay, breadth first. What does breadth first do? Essentially, it starts with Arad as a node, and then it generates all the nodes one level away from it, and then all the nodes one level away from it, and then before it expands any nodes 2 levels away from it, it must expand every node 1 level away from it. So it's going breadth. Okay, all the lower depth nodes are expanded before any higher depth node is expanded. That's it. That's what breadth first does. And since depth is a discrete thing, 0 depth, 1 depth, 2 depth, 3 depth, and so on, it's well, whatever I said completely specifies the algorithm. In terms of queuing strategy, all you need to do is when the new nodes come in, put it in the back of the queue, and you take it out from the end, front of the queue. That's breadth first. Okay. One of the interesting things is actually, you know, in this particular problem, you know, you're going like this, and so on. Imagine you are actually, your initial node is somewhere here, and you're going to get to some goal node. So the frontiers would then be, how would the frontiers go? So suppose, actually think of a simple scenario where you have a grid, okay? And you want to go from some point here to like some point here. And in the grid, you can basically assume that you can go up 1 unit, sideways 1 unit, down 1 unit, left 1 unit. Okay? Those are the things that you can do. Let's assume that. Okay? Now, in that kind of a scenario, what if you start from this node, the way breadth first search works, in essence, is after one iteration, it sort of looks at all the nodes here. After 2 iterations, it looks at all the nodes here, where each of these is the depth. Then 3, 4, like that. That's where it goes. So think of what breadth first search is doing as essentially looking in concentric depth circles around the start node. That's what it does. Now, given this, when I reach, so the question is it complete? If there is a path from the initial node to the goal node, would breadth first search ever not terminate without finding the path? I'm sorry. Will depth first search fail to find the path? Okay. The answer is, of course, that's not possible. It will always find the path because you are going very carefully in concentric circles. And so, you know, you would never have missed this guy and gone off to a higher circle, because when the circle went through this guy, you would have found him. That's the simplest way of understanding why breadth first search is complete. Okay? Is it optimal?
It will find the optimal solution.
If you define optimality in terms of depth, if all the operators have unit cost, then in fact it is optimal. Right? Agreed? Okay, so it is in fact going to be optimal too. It's both complete and optimal. What about the time? It's optimal basically because here is, okay, this is a good question. The way you always think of optimality of a search algorithm is by proof by contradiction. That's the best way to do it. Okay, so you would argue to yourself, okay, depth first search found this guy and it terminated. Okay, and I want to say that there was a node which is better, which was more optimal. The only, see, you can prove inoptimality by showing one counterexample. That's it. That's all you need. Okay, showing optimality requires showing that everybody else is worse than you. Showing inoptimality requires a counterexample. Okay, so if this guy were making a claim that he is optimal, you would start by arguing that maybe there is a goal. Suppose there is a node which is actually better than this. Okay, then I will argue that that's not possible. Because in essence, if there was a node which is at a better depth, it's a lower depth, then depth first search would have looked at it before it went here. That's it. In the concentric circles case, all we are saying is if you are in the circle 15, you have seen everything below circle 15, depth circle 15. So that's why it's optimal. But basically, this is the essence of the proof for optimality of all the algorithms that come with slight variations. What you would do is you'd argue to yourself by contradiction that assume that there is a node which is better than the node that my algorithm found. Then I'll prove that it could not be possible. So there's a contradiction if that were to happen. Because the contradiction in this case is if this was better than this, right? Here's the interesting thing. If this were better than this, what happens is even if this node and this node, if this and this node were both present on the open list at the same time, in the queue at the same time, clearly this guy would have been picked up for expansion before this guy. Yes? So that the only other possibility is this guy sneaked in later somehow. Okay, but that means at some point of time there is an ancestor of this node and an ancestor of this node who both stayed on the queue at the same time. And you can then prove that the ancestor of this node would have succeeded. And you would have seen this before this. Okay? We will look at this proof multiple times because we'll do this again for uniform cost search and A-star search. Okay, but basically the same idea. Okay, time. How many nodes would you expand? Obviously depends on the graph type. But if you have a uniform cost tree, uniform search tree with branching factor B and depth D, okay? So basically you have a tree, what? You have a tree like this. And my search node, in this case, what would be the, if the goal is at depth D, if the optimal goal is at depth D, okay, how many nodes would the depth first search have expanded in the worst case before it found that node? B power D. Of the order of B power D. Actually, it's worse, really. Okay, but it's of the order of B power D. Because it would expand every node here, every node here, every node here, every node here, and then, you know, with your luck, when you talk about complexity, you normally talk about worst case complexity. With your luck, you would have expanded all these nodes, picked up this node, and found that that's node to go with.
What did you say it was worse than B power D?
Because B power 0 plus B power 1 plus B power 2, etc. plus B power D. Okay? And which is basically B power D plus 1 if you do the geometric progression summation. Okay? But we just think in terms of B power D because that's exponential enough. That should make us feel worried. Okay? Now, what would be, if I tell you that the goal is at depth D, is there a significantly better case for breadth first search? Or is it always just as bad, more or less? So I get to put, this is the depth D. I can put the goal anywhere here in the depth D. Are there better places for the goal to be and worse places for the goal to be as far as the depth first search is concerned? In terms of the complexity, number of expansions.
It can be a little bit better.
A little better, but unfortunately it's still exponential. You could be better here, worse here, but there's still B power D. The reason I say this is because the next guy, depth first search, it makes a whole lot of difference. If you luck out big time. If you don't luck out, you would be just as big a loser as the other guys. Okay, so that's why it's interesting to know whether or not, you know, it is worst case, but the question is, if I have some flexibility as to where the goal occurs, would I have done better somehow? Okay. Space B power D. Because it would have kept the entire last fringe, before it starts expanding. At the time, think of the time when it's about to expand the leftmost node in the lowest depth. At that time, everybody else in that depth is already on the queue. Right? So that's the saddest part for breadth first search. It's B power D. Okay. So space is the big problem. Space really, surprisingly, is the big problem. For those of you who think programs take too long to run, you know, we are sunk anyway. You know, in fact, there is this joke that if it's not at least NP hard, we are not interested in this class. Okay, I mean, the problems of the sublinear and polynomial are for cheaper classes. We are at least NP hard. Okay, so we're going to be sunk. I mean, we're going to be sunk anyway. The question is, if I have the infinite patience and I can switch on my computer and go home and come back 3 days later, I would at least not want to see a segmentation fault. Right? And if I wind up needing one extra byte of space in the second day at 2 a.m. and I wasn't there, my program would have died. Okay, so the space is the problem. Okay, to get a feel for it, if a program generates nodes at 1 megabyte, I mean, the program, even this slide was written several years back, and you know, it's very easy to generate nodes at 1 megabyte per second. And so if you run for 24 hours, you could wind up filling 86 gigabytes, which is not as surprising now as it was a while back, because Windows already requires 4 gigabytes of RAM. Forget about secondary memory. Okay, but there are faster computers, and you know, but the space is more. I mean, we have more space available, but the space doesn't grow anywhere near the rate at which our human patience grows. You know, so here is a feeling. If your solution is at depth 0, 2, 4, 8, 10, 12, 14, etc. Okay, then assuming some simple characteristics of how much time is taken for each node expansion and how much space is taken per node on the queue, you essentially have about, you know, at the depth 12, I mean, so at depth 10, if you can be done in 128 days, but you would need 1 terabyte. And depth 14, it'll take 3,500 years and also requires 11,000 terabytes of space. Space is a problem, even if you don't mind the time. Okay. And I guess you will mind the time when it becomes 35 years, but yeah.
So it's so CPU bound that, well, ugly.
No, but ultimately the entire queue has to stay somewhere. I'm not even talking about, this is not main memory. I don't think even Bill Gates has this many terabytes of main memory yet.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, of course the guy thought 680K is enough for the entire computer less than 5 years back, so who knows what he has. But what I'm saying is, this is the entire memory. Even if you do in nice disks and, you know, all that stuff, you're still talking really bad scenarios. And this is just depth 14. It's just 14 actions. That's what you have to keep in mind. 14 actions, in the worst case, can take 3,500 years. Basically, with what did we think? B is 10. B is 10. That's the big deal.
What is the branch factor in this example?
Branching factor is 10. That's what I wrote. That's the...
Oh, okay.
You really hope that branching factor is as close to 1 as possible.
What does that mean?
That means for each node, there are 10 children. So you need huge family planning for the search node, so that they can't have more than at most one child. Okay. Around one child is okay. After that, obviously, it will start growing. But this, I mean, this is the dirty secret. I threw in a b equal to 10. But b equal to 10 is not that out of the world. You know, even for the tile puzzle, b is about 4. Right? Okay. Depth first search. You guys know depth first search, right? What's the difference in depth first search? You take the nodes that come in, put it in the front of the queue, and then take stuff from the front of the queue. What that means is, from the point of view of a tree, suppose these two are goal nodes. The way depth first search would work is, it will start with this, then it will expand this node, you will get these two onto the queue, then you will expand this node, you will get these two onto the queue, then you will expand this node, you will get this onto the queue, then you will expand it. When you expand it, you say it's a goal, you stop. Primogeniture, by the way, is a depth first strategy. So Prince Charles, kids will have a better chance of ruling UK in a rubber stamp way than Prince Charles' brother ever has. You know, unless Prince Charles' family gets wiped out, the brother has no chance. Okay? Basically, that's what depth first search is. Unless, once you go into this subtree, until this entire subtree is dead, you won't look at this subtree. That's the obvious idea, right? Now, is depth first search complete? Is it optimal first?
No.
It's not optimal. Is it complete?
Yeah.
Is it always complete?
No.
If I have graphs with cycles, I will keep going in nice cycles. So I'm not actually complete. Depth first search is only complete for finite search spaces. Breadth first search is complete even on graphs with cycles. It doesn't care. It can, you know, if there is a d-depth path to the goal, it will do a bunch of back and forth in between d-depth, but there is one path which goes directly to the d-depth that it does consider. So it will always end with the optimal path, irrespective of how big the graph is. So in essence, breadth first search, you know, if you have this basically a coordinate frame which is extending plus infinity, minus infinity in both directions, depth first search is dead, right? Whereas breadth first search is still complete. And depth first search, you agreed already, is not optimal. Breadth first search is optimal. Okay. It's not complete. What about time? So what about time? It's not optimal too. Okay. What about time? The worst case time would be if you have essentially a uniform search tree to depth d, where, you know, the goal node is occurring in the depth d. The best case is comes here. How many nodes has it expanded of the order of d? The worst case is how many nodes? B power d. So depth first search is the gambling strategy. Okay, it can luck out hugely. It can be done in just d expansion. But if it's unlucky, if it's mostly unlucky, maximally unlucky, it can take as many expansions as the breadth first search, b power d. The question is the following: on the average, is depth first significantly better than breadth first? Not significantly. So the problem there is, if there are b power d positions in the last level, there are b power d positions in the last level. Okay, this very good, this very bad, this not as good, this not as bad. If you add this and this, this and this, this and this, this and this, their sum is the same. It's the way Gauss computed, you know, the story of Gauss, who was young and in his class making too much noise, and the teacher asked him, you know, just add up the first 100 numbers, so that you can be, you know, busy doing that while I'm thinking of my lesson plan. And the guy right away gave the answer. Why? Because he realized 1 plus 100 is 101, 2 plus 99 is 101, and so on. So you essentially have the same sum multiplied half the number of times. And that's it, you're done. Okay. So what this means for us is even on the, it's not significantly better. It's still basically b power d plus d by 2, which is still b power d. Okay? So why do we care about depth first search? The reason we care about depth first search at all is it has a huge advantage. In the worst case, it will never take more than b times m memory, where m is the maximum depth to which the search goes. Okay? Because in essence, imagine what happens in the worst case for the depth first search. It will start here, it will generate b nodes, pick one, it will again generate b nodes, pick one, so this is b minus one, this is b minus one, pick one, and again generate b nodes, there is b minus one here, pick one and go on. Okay? So if you go to depth m, at each depth you have b minus one nodes sitting on the queue. You have to care about the worst case, not the best case for space. You know, there is nothing for space, best case doesn't make any sense. Okay? So in the worst case, you would take m times b minus 1 nodes on the queue, which is mb nodes. M is the maximum depth. So if in fact the maximum depth, the reason you think in terms of maximum depth rather than the solution depth is because breadth first search would never go more than the solution depth. Right? Depth first, our friend, on the other hand, would reach infinity before it ever backtracks, unless the tree ends. So if on a tree of maximum depth m, if all the solutions are at depth d, right, breadth first will take b power d, maximum space. Depth first will take b times m, maximum space, where m is the number of levels that it can go. Okay? So that's the good thing about depth first. The question I have is, this is a huge thing. B times m versus b power d, or b power m, more or less. Huge, huge difference. Okay? Everywhere else, both of them, both breadth first and depth first are identical. So the space-wise, depth first is a huge winner. The question is, can I get depth first to be both complete and optimal, while keeping the linear space advantage? Okay? That's the question. Think of a simple idea, which is, irrespective of how big the tree is, I put a depth limit. And I will say I will only go up to depth m. Okay? And if there are solutions, and I know, for example, that there exist at least solutions below depth m, okay, then if I can go only up to m, that means I'll never go to infinitely large distances. So that means I will terminate. So if there is any finite depth goal node which is less than m levels deep somewhere else, I would have found it. Right? So depth limited depth first search essentially doesn't have infinite state space size. It has finite state space size. And so it can actually be complete. It will, you know, as long as there are solutions above the maximum depth you're going to. In most problems, you might be able to guess what's the maximum depth you would ever have to go, and then just put that as a depth limit and search only above that. And so depth first search would become complete in that case. And it is still clearly linear space. Right? The next question, and that's the last thing I'll do, is what if I keep changing my limit, depth limit? Suppose I say in the beginning I will say depth limit is 1. Depth limit is 0 essentially. So I would never expand even a single node. And so in this tree I will only consider this part of the tree. So there is a limit here. So I would not expand the tree beyond that. If there is a goal node here using depth first search, I'll find it. If not, I will increase the depth limit by 1. And now I have this tree, this. So when I come here, when I try to expand this node, even though child generator says there are these two children, I'll say to heck with you because their depth is more than my depth limit. So I'll act as if you don't have children. So then what happens is it will see this and this and this, and if any of them are goal nodes, it'll stop. If not, go one more level. This is iterative deepening depth first search. Iterative deepening depth first search. What's the hugely advantageous idea about it? It's optimal. It's complete, it's optimal. You don't have to guess where the solution is. You're starting from zero depth, and if in fact your initial node is the goal node, you would be done there. If not, you would do one depth tree, do a depth first search, two depth tree, do a depth first search, and so on. Iterative deepening depth first search has the same space complexity as normal depth first search because in each iteration you are still doing depth first search. Okay? It is complete because if there ever is a finite depth goal, you would have found it before you went to La La Land. Okay? It's also and it's optimal because if there is a goal node at depth D, you would have found it before finding a goal node at depth D plus 1. So it's optimal because goal nodes at depth D would have been found in the Dth iteration using the depth first search. And remember that when you are in the Dth iteration, that means there was no goal node up to depth D minus 1. That's why you came to the Dth iteration. So it's very nice. There are no goals above me. And if there is a node here, I will find it before I go further down.
Yeah, how about time?
Time. What about the time? Turns out, time is not that bad. If you are thinking anyway, it's not that bad. Why? Because the exponentials help us. Okay? Because if you do, previously you were doing, basically what you're doing is, you're doing this tree plus this whole tree plus this whole tree. You are repeatedly counting some of the nodes. And yet, because of the way search space increases exponentially from level to level in terms of the branching factor, it turns out that iterative deepening depth first search to depth first search is something like b plus 1 by b. So the number of expansions that iterative deepening depth first search would do with respect to a depth first search would do on the average for the same depth goal node is only b plus 1 by b factor. Okay. However, there is going to be a homework question which will ask you to think of what could this be in the worst case. The worst case happens when the branching factor, actually it's like, it's not b plus 1 by b, I think it's like b by b minus 1. Okay. And the worst case happens when branching factor is 1. Right, and in that case, that particular asymptotic analysis is not correct, but you can do analysis yourself for single branching, single branch search tree. What is a single branch search tree, by the way? It's just a straight line. So I looked at this node, and I looked at this and this, I looked at this, 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 and so on. So it's 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4, sort of a thing. Okay, so think about it, how much is bigger, how big it is compared to just going all the way down. Okay, so we will look at iterative deepening depth first search again a little bit next class, which is on Wednesday, but it's a hugely good idea overall because it has optimality, it has completeness, and its time complexity is only a little worse, if you're thinking anyway, than the time complexity of normal depth first search. Okay, you can look up, you know, the simple analysis in terms of geometric progressions in the book, but we can also do it next class. It's not all that hard. Okay? We'll stop here.